We are in John chapter 4. It's where we left off. If you were here last week, you remember it was Jesus with his encounter at the woman at the well in Samaria, where he progressively took her through the revelation of who he was, starting out with a man, a Jew, Jewish man, to being sir, to being, I think you're a prophet, when he told her, you're right, you... She said, when she said, I don't have a husband, and he said, you're right, you've had five, and what you have now is not a husband. I think you're a prophet. And then to the realization that he is the Messiah, the one who gives living water. And so she went back and told all of the men of the city. And in verse 39 it said, and many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman, which testified, he told me all that I ever did. Which I'm sure freaked out some of the men, knowing some of the things she had done. So when the Samaritans were come unto him, they besought him that he would tarry with them. And he abode there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word. And again, that's important because it's going to play into what we're talking about this week. You know, Romans 10:17, faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. The word is the thing that produces more faith than anything else, for sure. It was his own words. They believed the testimony of the woman, and there were some who believed through that, but there were many more, it said, who believed because they heard his words. And it's interesting, as we come into this week, they said in verse 42, and said to the woman, now we believe not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world. You know, there are certain movements within the church today. There's the emerging movement, and it's all about conversation, about dialogue. We need to sit and we need to dialogue, and we need to talk about the things and why we believe, and everybody gets to say their part, and you know, and then through the long conversations and everything, we're going to see Jesus speaking to two different people this week. The first guy is a nobleman. Jesus says 16 words to him. The second guy is a lame guy. He gets a longer talk. He actually gets 27 words. That's it. 16 words. And both of these guys' lives are completely turned around through very brief yet to the point encounters with Christ, hearing his word. It starts out in verse 43. It's where we pick up. It says, now after 2 days he departed thence, this is from Samaria, and went into Galilee. For Jesus himself testified that a prophet hath no honor in his own country. He is from that area. They are very familiar with Jesus. In fact, in a lot of ways, they're too familiar with him because he's going to go there. And it tells us in Mark 6 that he actually marvels at their unbelief because they look at him and they say, aren't you, you know, Mary's boy, carpenter, brother, James, Josie's got some sisters. We know you. Who are you? We don't, you know. And because they thought they knew Jesus and they had him pegged in a hole, they were so familiar with him, they couldn't receive him. And there are a lot of people who, because of their false familiarity, they think they know Jesus, but they don't. They don't accept him for who he is because they think they got him all nailed down. I mean, how many people do you know, oh yeah, Jesus, great teacher, all about tolerance. He was about love and tolerance. It's like, have you even heard anything he said? You know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. I mean, he says all of these exclusive things. And he goes to Galilee. And they're almost too familiar with him. They don't know who he is. It says in verse 45, then when he was come into Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did at Jerusalem at the feast, for they also went to the feast. And he did some great stuff. We read at the feast. It was the feast of it was the Passover, one of the mandatory feasts. He was in Israel. That was the one where he kicked over the tables of the money changers. And, of course, a lot of people will rally behind somebody who's kicking over the tables of the religious people. That was when he said, you know, you destroy this temple in 3 days. I'll build it back up again. And then it told us back in chapter 2, verse 23, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover and the feast day, many believed in his name when they saw the miracles he did, because he did a bunch of miracles while he was there. Many believed in his name when he saw the miracles he did, but it continued, verse 24, but Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men, and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. The phrase, did not commit himself, it's the same as the believed. It said they all believed in him because they saw his miracles, and he said, but he didn't believe in them because he knew who they were. and that their belief in him, whatever belief they had, was based upon seeing some miracle, that's extremely fickle faith. Because if it's based upon a sign or a wonder or an experience, when that sign or that wonder or that experience goes away, or the feeling goes away, the faith goes with it. But if it's based upon the word stands forever, and it never goes away. And so these people in Galilee, they saw what Jesus had done, and they followed him, but he didn't believe in them. He knew that their faith was extremely shallow. In fact, he's going to mention that again here in just a second. So he's in Galilee, and in verse 46 it says, "So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine, and there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, he went unto him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death." He's in Cana of Galilee, and there is a nobleman. The literal translation of the word underneath that in the Greek, it's a king's man. He's most likely a member of Herod Antipas's court. Which probably makes him a relative to some degree. Nepotism was alive and well back then. And so he was a king's man, a man of authority, of position, of power. He's a guy who's used to having things done for him. He's used to getting his way. He's used to saying and having other people do. But he's got a problem. He's run into the one common denominator in life, and that his son is sick, and his son is very sick, sick to the point of death. And there is one thing in this life that levels the playing field. It's that everybody dies. Everybody gets sick at some point or other. Everybody has a relative get sick. It doesn't matter how much money you have in a lot of cases, and it doesn't matter how much power or authority. This guy had got to the place where his son was sick, and he was powerless to do anything about it. Any of you who have kids understand, or any of you who've had someone you love get sick, it's a horrible place to be. I know. You know, I've spent many nights, and I'm sure there are those of you who have kids who have felt the same way, where you're there and your kids are sick, and they're real sick, and they're suffering. And you pray, and you say, "Lord, just could you make this stop? Could you make this stop?" In fact, I don't know if you're like me. I've got to that place before. I've been, "God, give it to me. Let me take it. I'll take it. Just let them not be sick anymore. I just don't want to see them suffer. I can't stand it. There's nothing I can do. Oh, Lord, I'm so powerless. Please, just put it on me." Well, that's where this guy was. He's desperate. He's completely out of options, because for a man who is a member of Herod's court, who is used to having things done for him, and is now, he's grasping at straws, and the only hope he has is he hears this guy, Jesus, over in Galilee. He's in Capernaum. It's like 25 miles or more. It's not 25 miles of highway. It's 25 miles of rough terrain, of hiking. And he's at the point where the son's about ready to die, so he's out of options, you know. And it's his last hope. And so he makes the journey. It says he besought him in verse 47. Literally, he begged. He begged this carpenter. And you know why he did it? Because he loves his son, you know. Anybody, if you got a lot of money, you can still love your kids. If you don't have any money, you still love your kids, and it pains you when they're sick. When there's someone that you love that's helpless and powerless and suffering, you do whatever you can do. You grasp at whatever straws are there. And this man has grasped at the last straw, which is to go find Jesus and see what he'll do. So he goes to him and he begs, this king's man, this nobleman. And look what Jesus says to him. Jesus said unto him, "Except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." You know, this guy is there, and he's come all this way, and he's desperate for his son. And Jesus says to him, and the "ye" in this, "except ye see signs and wonders, ye will not believe." It's plural, so he's talking about all that. But we just read that the people in Galilee, you know, he wasn't welcome in his own home. I mean, they had some kind of faith that was based on seeing miracles, but they didn't have a real belief in who he was. They just had seen some things, and they knew he could do cool things. This guy comes. He comes all the way, and he begs Jesus to help. And Jesus just lumps him in with everybody else and says, "You know what? Unless you see a sign, you're not going to believe." Which this guy is not here as a disciple. Okay, this is not a disciple of Jesus. He isn't. He never followed him before in his life, but he's run out of options and there's nothing left but this Jesus guy. Maybe I'll try him. And he's not there because he has great faith, because when he gets there and says, would you come heal my son? Jesus says, unless I do a wonder, you're not going to believe. You don't even believe. You're here and you don't believe that I can do it. I mean, that's what he's really saying. You're here asking because you have no other choice, but it's not because you're really expecting it. You ever been in that position where you go to the Lord, and I know you have, Lord, please, you know, so-and-so's got cancer, please heal him. And yet, there's that part of you that's like, I remember when I was still going down to Calvary Warrington, and the guy who was over, used to be U-Turn, turned into Seven Oaks, Chuck Perry, got throat cancer, and he'd had it. It was in his neck, and they cut out a hunk of his neck, and he came back again. He had a tumor actually growing around his artery, and they'd done the chemo, and he was, you know, going through all the stuff with the chemo, and he was going in for surgery, and they were going to have to do it again, and they brought him into the hospital, and you know, they'd done all their pictures and all that stuff, and then he was going in the next day, and the guys from church dropped him off, and then, you know, he goes in, and the doctor does his last look over and says, we're not going to operate. What do you mean you're not going to operate? He says, well, there's nothing there. It's gone. I don't know what to say. It's gone, you know. And he calls up and he's like, Ken, you got to come get me. You know, the cancer, you're healed. And Ken's like, great man of faith that I am. Really? I mean, that's, you know. And you know, look, you pray over and over, you know, Lord, please heal him. But you're like, no way, it's cancer. I mean, it's not like it's a headache, you know, where you say, oh, Lord, please heal him. Here, take a couple aspirin and beat it. I mean, this is like cancer. Oh, Lord. But there's that part of you. You know he can do it. You've heard he can do it, but you haven't seen it enough. I mean, all you've seen is weird stuff on TV, but you haven't really seen, like, the big ones, or if you have, it's very rare. And so it's not like you're coming with all this faith, which is, I like that, because, you know, there are a lot of people who would try to lay this trip on you that it's really based upon your faith. You've got to be coming with all of this faith in order to get healed. And if you don't work up enough faith, you've got to be like that, you know, train from the kid's story, you know, you've got to work up this thing, and then they lay that stupid trip on you, and you better keep your faith up or you'll lose your healing. Because we see that all over the place, you know, Jesus healing people and then their eyes falling back out and their noses falling off. I mean, you don't see that. But anyways, so he comes to Jesus. Sorry, I don't want to rant. They come to Jesus, and he says, unless you see a sign or a wonder, you won't believe. Because what is the saying that we have in this world? Seeing is believing. Well, no, it's not. Seeing is seeing. Believing, having faith, is actually believing when you don't see. That's the whole thing about faith, is trusting when you don't have the sign. And so he just calls him out. I mean, really, what Jesus is doing when this guy comes is saying, you don't even believe me, do you? You really don't. I mean, you're not going to believe that I can do this thing unless I actually do it. Unless you see me do it, you don't believe. I'm sure that's not what that guy wanted, you know? But he doesn't argue. When Jesus makes that statement, unless you see a sign or a wonder, you're not going to believe. The nobleman in verse 49 saith unto him, sir, come down ere my child die. He doesn't argue. Oh, no, I believe. I really do. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, that's not true. He appeals to Jesus with compassion. He says, yeah, but he's going to die. Okay, you're right. Maybe I don't have the faith that I should have when I come to you, but if you don't do something, he's going to die. And look what Jesus says to him. He didn't give him the answer he wants. Jesus saith unto him, go thy way, thy son liveth. He came to Jesus and he said, come, you got to come. Just come, you know, heal him, do the thing. Would you come heal him? And Jesus says, go, he's all set. That's it? What do you mean? That's it? Just go, he's fine. Yeah, but you haven't even been there. It's 25 miles away. I mean, and it's funny because Jesus gives him an answer that requires faith on his part. Jesus calls him out when he comes and says, you don't even have faith. If you don't see it, you're not going to believe. And the guy doesn't argue that. He says, yeah, but he's going to die. Would you do something? And Jesus gives him an answer that requires a response of faith on his part. You know, you ever watch the stuff on TV? You know, the Christian comedy channel where they do the healings and the signs and the wonders, and it's got to be a show. you know, we got to parade them up on stage and we've got to do a big thing. And of course, we never see anybody healed. We always hear about people who somehow came sick that we never saw, but now they're healed and they want to come up and show you that they can walk. Of course, we didn't see them not walking before. We just see them walking now. But you expect something. You expect the flash. You expect the smack on the forehead. You expect the big thing, you know. And that's been there all along. There's a great account in 2 Kings where there's a guy named Naaman. He's not Israelite. Is he Assyrian? And he's in the military. And he's a leper. Leprosy. There's no cure for leprosy. Nobody is healed of leprosy. They're cleansed. It's something that it's an impossible thing to do. And yet they hear in Assyria that there's a prophet in Israel that can heal people. And so the king of Assyria sends this Naaman over to the king of Israel and says, "Hey, I heard you got somebody who can fix him. Would you fix him up?" And the king flips out. He's like, "Who am I that I can do this?" And Elisha is the prophet at the time, and he tells the king, "Send him down, and then they'll know that God's here." So this Naaman shows up, and he's got this big train with him. You know, he's expecting the big thing. He's leprosy. Leprosy is a rotting disease. Great picture of sin, because what happens is leprosy, you lose feeling. You lose feeling in your extremities. It starts in your fingertips and your outer extremities. So the nerves aren't there. So what happens is you hit yourself and you don't feel it. You cut yourself, you don't notice it. And so it gets infected and you begin to bruise and damage your outer things. And because you don't feel the pain, which you think would be a blessing, "Oh, that'd be awesome if I could slam my finger with a hammer and not even feel it. Wouldn't that be great?" Well, no, because you wouldn't pull it away and you'd keep hitting it. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And so, you know, if somebody with leprosy, they get infected and they start to rot off and they're missing digits and they're missing noses. And, you know, it's not a good disease. So this guy shows up all rotty and he goes to Elijah. And it says in 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 9, "So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot, and he stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and you shall be clean.'" And it says, "But Naaman was wroth, and he went away, and he said, 'Behold, I thought he'll surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and strike the hand over the place and recover the leper.'" Well, I expected him to come out and say big words and do, you know, alakazoo and watch it happen. And he just said, he didn't even come out. He sent somebody to tell me to go take a bath in the river. And Naaman gets all ticked, like, "I wanted to be healed and I needed a big show." And then finally his servants are smarter than he is. And he said, "Look, if he'd have told you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? If he'd have said, 'Hey, if you can just go kill the dragon, then you'll be healed,' you'd have done the thing, or you'd have brought back the apples from the end of the earth. All he said was, 'Go take a bath in the river 7 times. Why not try it? I mean, what do you got to lose?'" So he does it and he's healed. Well, here, this guy wanted Jesus to come. He expected him to come and do the thing, "Lay hands on my son, whatever it is you do, and heal him." And Jesus doesn't give him that. "That's too easy. No, because if I do that, then you can walk with me and you'll..." No. Go. It's all done. Go. And he brings him to a place where he is forced to exercise his faith. And look what he does. Verse 50. "And the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken unto him, and he went his way." Now, when he got there, he didn't believe. Jesus called him out on it. "You don't believe." And yet something happened in that little exchange where Jesus explained what his heart was, and he says, "Yeah, but my son's going to die." And then Jesus says, "Go your way, he's made whole." And the guy now has to go back 25 miles. But he doesn't say, "No, but you have to come." He doesn't argue. He says he believes. There's something happened in that little transaction where this guy went from not really thinking Jesus could do it to realizing that Jesus would. And the question is, why? What was it, do you think, that brought that guy to the place of believing Christ? I'll tell you why, I think. Any of you guys who have kids, I don't do it as much as I should, but it's fun to read with my kids. We homeschool our kids, and so part of their curriculum is built, a lot of it is, it's a literature-based thing, so my wife reads a lot. But I like to do it sometimes, too. And one of the series that I went through with my kids was the C.S. Lewis Chronicles of Narnia books, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. They did that movie about it. They're doing other ones. Well, I don't know if you've ever read through those, but there's one of them that I really like, and it's great because you can see pictures of Christ through the whole thing. Aslan the lion is a picture of Christ. Well, there's one of the books. It's called The Magician's Nephew, and it's kind of the creation story of that land that they live in. And there's a boy who's and a girl who are yanked into that world when it's first formed, and you know the witch is there and all of that. the boy's mother back in England is dying. She's got this disease and she's wasting away. And the boy is in Narnia, and you know, he makes some mistakes. Evil gets into the land. It's his fault. The world is brand new, and he's brought this evil in there, and now he's got to fix the thing. And yet, in his mind, he's just, my mom. I want to do something for my mom, and I, you know. And so, you know, the lion is telling him what he has to go do. He's got to go get this apple from the mounts to be the tree of life and bring it back, and that'll do some stuff. But it says he's looking at the ground, and because it's all he's thinking about is his mom. And finally, he looks up to ask the lion, you know, what about my mom? And when he does, it says he's shocked, because when he looks the lion in the face, there's a tear in the lion's eye. And the lion tells him, you know, this world is brand new, and you and I are the only ones in this world right now who understand true grief. And I think it was this man looked at Jesus in the eye, and he saw something in him where he understood. Jesus knew the boy. Jesus knew the boy better than the dad did. You know, you look at what the scriptures say about him in Isaiah 53. It says that he is despised and rejected of men. He's a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He understands. Shortest verse in the Bible we'll get to later in John 11:35. It says Jesus wept. The scene where Jesus weeps is when his friend Lazarus, Mary and Martha's brother, is dead. And Jesus shows up and they say to him, Lord, if you'd have been here, he'd have lived. And it says Jesus wept. Now, you think about that. Why is Jesus crying? He's about to raise Lazarus from the dead. He's not crying for Lazarus. In fact, Lazarus is probably going to be the one who should be crying, because he's going to get yanked back from paradise and stuck back in that body again. And yet, when Jesus comes and he sees his friends suffering the result of sin, they see the separation, the pain, the sorrow, it says Jesus weeps. And I think this guy sees the same love in Jesus' eye for his son that he feels himself. You know, it tells us in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities. But he was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. And because of that, it says, let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace and help to help in time of need. And I think this guy looked Jesus in the eye and he realized, he loves my son more than I do. And he tells me that it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. So he goes. He goes his way. He went. And I think that's important. The man believed, and he went. Please don't try to tell me you believe if you never go. You know, James makes a big deal of it in his book. In James 2:18, he says, yeah, a man may say you have faith, and I have works. He says, show me your faith without your works. I'll show you my faith by my works. You can tell me all day long that you believe what I say. If you really believe, you're going to go and do what it is I told you to do. And for us, the same thing is true. If you say you believe, then go and do. And he does. And think about this. He's got at least four or five hour walk or a jog or whatever over rough territory to find out whether or not it's true. Is it true? I mean, he's got faith. We know he believes. But there's still got to be that apprehension that what is the truth? And it says in verse 51, as he was now going down, his servants met him, and they told him, saying, your son liveth. His servants are coming to get him, saying, you don't have to bring him because he's okay now. And says, then inquired he of them the hour when he began to amend. When did he start feeling better? What time did it, when was the moment when he started, you know, you saw some improvement and he started to get a little better? And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. There was no starting. No, you don't understand. He was just better. There was no rehab. There was no, I'll have a bit of toast. It was at 7 o'clock, bing, your boy is up in bed and he's completely fine. The fever left. It's a complete and total immediate, he was healed. And it was yesterday at the seventh hour. So the father knew that it was at the same hour in which Jesus had said unto him, thy son liveth. And himself believed in his whole house. This again, the second miracle that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea into Galilee. And truthfully, he believed in the whole house. This was the goal of the miracle, okay? Yes, Jesus loved that boy and he wanted him to be healed. he could have done it without even meeting the guy. If it was all about that boy being well, he could have healed him before the father ever left. He could have just, yeah, that was a kid, sick kid over there. Okay, done. Let me just keep going. I mean, that could have been what he... But he didn't. Because he wanted to do more than just heal the boy physically. He wanted to heal that whole family and make them all whole. You know, this guy goes back. He's still called a nobleman. He's still a king's man. He's just got a different king now. And what happens is, as a result of what Jesus did, he believed on one step. He saw that it was true. And then he did the only thing that's rational when you find out that the first thing that Jesus says is true is to completely surrender and embrace wholeheartedly. And I like what it says. He himself believed, and when he did, his whole house followed. And, let me encourage you men. If you believe wholeheartedly, if you surrender your life completely to Jesus Christ, almost guaranteed your family will follow. Ladies, it's a little harder for you, but I know that there's a position that a dad has in a family. And if dad is sold out and he's 100% on board for Jesus Christ, and the children and the wife see that the man is real in what he believes and he is the leader of that family, they're going to follow. They're going to follow. I had no doubt who my father's God was. I knew. He was sold out. And I think that's what we see here. Now, chapter 5, we'll get into this to see the second guy. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Not sure which one. There were a few mandatory feasts. My thought, personally, is that this is the Feast of Pentecost, about 50 days after Passover. Some people say, no, it's a whole year later, and it's the second Passover. Some people say it's Purim or one of the... You can put whatever one you want in there. I don't know for sure. The mandatory feast, Jesus goes up because he did obey the law. He was respectful of the law while he was there. It says in verse 2, now, there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market, it's the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. Bethesda it means the house of mercy, the house of grace. That has been found. When you look at this whole section right here, there are some, the way this pool was, it's a square or kind of a rectangle, and on four sides there were these porches, these little covered colonnades or whatever you call them that people could sit on, and there was one in the middle that kind of divided into two halves, so there was five porches or places to be around this. And for a long time, they said, well, that wasn't really a literal thing. This isn't all an allegory. And the five, because this guy's going to be sick for 38 years, and 38 is how long the Israelites wandered in the wilderness, and five represents the five books of the law, and blah, 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 blah. And maybe it does. I don't know. But then they went and found the thing, so there really is one, and it's really next to the sheep gate, which is kind of the marketplace area. So there's this pool called the Bethesda. And notice who's there. In these, on these porches, lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whomsoever then, first after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. There's a great multitude there. And this, I mean, yes, we're talking about a real literal event, a real literal man, but there's some overlying stuff in here. And if this doesn't describe us, the world, nothing does. Impotent, it means sick, people with no strength, powerless. The idea is somebody who is paralyzed, you know, where the mind will say to the arm or to the leg, move, but it just doesn't happen. There's something broken and there is no strength, no ability, no power to move on their own. The sick people were there. The blind, can't see. If that doesn't describe us, nothing does. Halt. Halt means crippled, lame. And if lame isn't a great word to describe the human race, I don't know what is, because we are pretty lame. And then the last one is withered. It's shrunken. It's wasted. Lame and wasted, if that isn't a great description of the world. But those of you, if you've ever seen somebody who's in a wheelchair and can't use their legs, the muscles atrophy to nothing, and it's just wasted away. And so this, all around this pool are all the sick folk. They're lame, they're halt, they're blind, they're wasted. really interesting verse. This causes some people some problems, verse 4, because it says, an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then, first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatsoever disease. Apparently, at some point, the thing would bubble. Now, this place was spring-fed, so it had some, you know, it wasn't just stagnant, but it would have some motion to it. But the scripture says that an angel will go down. And there's a law, you read the commentators, and a lot of people, well, that wasn't really an angel. It should say that the common thought at the day was that it... If this was in the Old Testament, nobody would have any problem with it at all. I mean, I read that thing about Naaman where Elisha said, go dunk yourself in the water 7 times and you're healed, and he was healed. There's some crazy, weird stuff that happens in the Bible. I don't know if you've read through it, but there's really weird stuff that goes on. There's another great one about Elisha. In 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 20, Elisha died and they buried him. And the bands of the Moabites invaded the land at the coming of the year. These roving raiders would come in. And it says, and it came to pass, one verse, I'd like to have more information, as they were burying a man, that behold, they spied a band of men. In other words, this guy died, and they're getting ready to bury him, and all of a sudden they see a party of raiders come, and they cast the man into the sepulcher of Elisha. So they ain't got time to bury him, they've got to get away, so they just take his body and they chuck it into Elisha's tomb, because that just happens to be where they are. It says, and when the man was let down and touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. They chuck a dead guy in, and he hits Elijah's bones, and boom, all better. I mean, how do you explain that? And that's all you get. No great grand scheme of why, no the rest of the story of this man's life. Just he was dead, and he touched those bones, and he came to life. Now, you can read that, and nobody says, well, it wasn't, he didn't actually come alive. It was, but you read it in the New Testament, and everybody gets weirded out by an angel. It says an angel went down to touch the waters. Why? Who knows? Maybe God said, I want to do this really cool thing with this lame guy, and I've got to have a way to get a whole bunch of lame, sick, halt people to hang out around this pool. So, yo, Fred, the angel, I want you to go down there and just take a bath, like maybe once a week, and just kind of splash, and when you do, the first guy that hits the water, heal him. You know? Because when you look at the story, it says this guy's been sick for 38 years, and he's been laying here a long time. This place is filled with people who are sick because apparently... some people, every once in a while, get healed from being around here. So, I'll take it at what it says. It must have happened. People laying there, day after day, halt, sick, impotent folk, blind. The first one in gets healed. It says, and a certain man was there, which had an infirmity, 38 years. If you'd like to insert yourself into the story, go ahead. Works good for me because I'm still 38 for a few more months. So 38 years. This guy, think about that. For the length of my life, this guy's been sick, halt, whatever. And look, we're going to see by the end of the story, there's a cause behind this guy's sick. He is sick as a result of sin. Okay? Now, anybody who is sick, is halt, or whatever, is that way because of sin, all right? But don't get me wrong, not necessarily specific sin. There is sin in this world, and the result of that is that some people, bad stuff happens. Everybody dies, okay? There are those who just come into this world in that condition, and it's not because they did something wrong. You know, there's a place we're going to get to in John chapter 9 where Jesus and the disciples are going, and they come upon this blind guy, and they... his disciples, being the brilliant theologians that they are, his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, oh, no. And he says, neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. You know, I have a daughter. She came out of the chute with some brain and other abnormalities. She didn't do anything wrong other than to be born to the sinful parents. That way, but because of this sin and death, and this is a fallen world, stuff happens, okay? There are things that happen as a result of sin in general. Nobody's fault. Then there is stuff that happens as a reward for being stupid. There's the results of sin, individual sin, you know? Proverbs 13, verse 15 says, the way of the transgressor is hard. It's no wonder when somebody drinks for 30 years that they get cirrhosis of the liver. I think it's a fair thing to say you brought that on yourself. There are people who have AIDS or herpes or some other nasty, rotting disease. because of bad behavior on their part. I mean, truthfully, when you think about it, and I understand there are some people who get AIDS because of blood transfusion. There are some people who were born to a parent with AIDS. But that is a disease that could be completely wiped out with a change of behavior in one generation. Because if just everybody who had it stopped fornicating and stopped using intravenous drugs, it would die out in one generation because nobody else would catch it. And I know there are people who have it who didn't ask for it. But there is sin that's a result, a penalty, it's a result of sin. There's a site out on the internet if you want to see something that tells a very powerful story. Go online and look for Faces of Meth. And it's put out by some police department. And all it is just a video. It's just a before and after series of pictures of people who got addicted to crystal meth. What they looked like when they first got arrested and what they looked like 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road. Some of them, they have people who've been arrested 15 times and they'll have a series of pictures on how they degrade. And you see, and it's horrible when you see what their sin does to them. You know, people who come in looking bright and happy and cheery, and then 2 years later they look like they've been, you know, beat with a rubber mallet because they've abused themselves through this drug. And there's, you know, this guy, from what we see later on, is there as a result of something he did. We don't know what. You know, people speculate that he, you know, I don't know, venereal disease or something. I don't know. All I know is this guy is there. He's been there for 38 years. And for me, being 38 years old, there are some people who say, well, I've been this way as long as I can remember. I've always been this way. This is how I am. I've been this way forever. You can't, you know. Well, this guy's been sick for 38 years. He's been halt, withered. It says, and when Jesus saw him lie and knew, notice that, Jesus knew. He always knows, all right? He's not looking for information. He knows exactly who this guy is. In fact, he goes into the middle of a sea of sick, withered people trying to get healed, and he finds this guy. And it's not the good guy. It's the guy who's there because he did something wrong. And he finds this guy, knew how long he'd been there, and he said to him, wilt thou be made whole? Is that a stupid question or what? I mean, here's a guy who's laying there, okay? They're all there. They want to get healed. That's why they're there, because that's what happens occasionally to some people. And he goes up to this guy, and he says to him, do you want to be made? And he's what he's asking, he's really going, he's asking about his desire. The equivalent would be to go to this guy and say, are you satisfied being there? Are you satisfied? And it's a good question, because, you know, people would go by there, and that's a place of begging as well. That was how people who were, you know, had various, there's no social security or SSI or anything else in those days, and so people would have to beg if they had no other way. So people could make pretty good money as beggars, actually. And I remember when I lived down in New Jersey in the early 90s, there was, on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, there was a woman, and I was reading some stuff on her last night because I wanted to refresh myself. Her name was Tate Harrington, and she was born, she was a short woman, but she was born and her arms and her legs didn't work. She was basically on a bed all the time. And she actually got married. She had a couple kids, I think, and her husband died. And she actually went to trial because the state wanted to take her kids away because they figured she's got her arms and her legs don't work. She's laying on a bed. She can't take care of her kids anymore. She's got a two-year-old. The way she won her court cases, they brought her two-year-old child in, and with her mouth, she changed his diaper to prove that she could do it, and they immediately gave her full custody. She didn't want to go on the state, so she went and enrolled and took a class and learned to play the piano with her tongue. And they would bring her down to the boardwalk in Atlantic City, and she would sit outside of the casinos playing Amazing Grace and other songs with her tongue on a keyboard. Now, you just hit it big in a casino and you walk out and there's some woman who's laying on a bed and whose arms and legs don't work and she's playing the piano with her tongue. You shell out the cash. And there were years where she made over $100,000 a year sitting on the boardwalk playing, you know, and it was an amazing woman, or, you know, I don't know. There's a biography out about her, but I think she's dead now. But, you know, if you've got a good shtick, you can make some money doing this. And it could have been possible the guy would have wanted to stay in that condition because it was his way of making a living. That may seem stupid to you, but how many people do you know that are in a crippling condition? They're in a place where they're being chewed up by their sin, and yet they don't want to stop. I like the bottle. I like the needle. I like the whatever other sin, fill in the blank. I want to stay this way. And you say, yeah, but you can be free of this. You don't have... Yeah, but I like the bottle. The bottle is my friend. Well, Jesus asks him, do you have a desire to be made whole? And if the guy says no, it ends right there. I like the guy's answer, okay? Because the impotent man answered him, sir, I have no man. When the water is troubled, to put me into the pool, but while I'm coming, another steps down before me. His answer is, well, of course I want to be made whole. That's why I'm here. I just can't. Don't you understand? I can't. Because his position is hopeless. Here's the deal. The first one into the water gets healed. I can't move. If my legs work, I could be the first one in the water. But my legs don't work, and the only way they can work is to be the first one into the water. But nobody puts me in the water, and every time it happens, somebody else gets in first. Don't you hate that? Someone else always... You ever hear that? It's always somebody else. They always get the guy. They always get the job. They always get healed, and I get the short end of the stick. And I have nobody... The man is trying to keep me down. Yeah. You know, and that's so many people. It's the man. I just need a man. You know, the man is not in my favor. I wish the man was on my... I don't have anybody else. It's always somebody else. And what he says is pretty profound. I have no man. I need the man to get me in the water. And it's not that I don't want to be healed. I can't. I am physically unable. I want to, but I don't have the man. The cool thing is standing in front of him is the one of whom they will say, Pilate, behold, the man. And the man, he thinks... He's got God in a box. My only hope is to get in that water, and I just can't. I want to be made whole, but I can't. I don't have the ability. And Jesus saith unto him, rise, take up thy bed and walk. Water? No stinking water. Rise, take up your bed and walk. And what he does is what Jesus does to all of us, is he shows him the one thing that's physically impossible for him to do. You told him to rise. He just told you he can't move. I mean, that's the problem. He can't rise. If he could rise, But he tells him, he shows him the one thing that he can't do, and he commands him to do it. But as Jesus always does, he never commands you to do anything. He doesn't give you the ability to do. And this guy is told, rise, take up your bed and walk. See, and the cool thing about that is, you know, a lot of people think, well, to get right, I want to come to Jesus, but my life is so screwed up. I can't go to him now. I'm a stinking druggie, or I'm an alcoholic, or I'm in, you know, an adulterous relation, or whatever I am. Once I get cleaned up, then I'll come to Jesus. You miss the point. You come to Jesus, and then he cleans you up. You know, he gives you the ability. If you could clean yourself up, you wouldn't need Jesus. You need Jesus so that you can get clean. And so this guy is told three things. All right, he's told to rise, and then he gives him the ability to do that. Then he says, take up your bed. What's the point of that? Well, I think, personally, he says, take up your bed, so that there's no opportunity for that guy to get back in it again. Because a lot of people get up, but they leave the bed there thinking, you know, I've been in that, that's not a bad bed. And, you know, if this doesn't work out, or if I lose my healing, I might have to get back into that bed. So I'm just going to leave that bed, or I'm just going to leave that bottle in the fridge, or I'm just going to leave those magazines under the bed, or I'm just going to keep subscription to whatever it is. Romans 13:14 says, Romans 13:14. Put you on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Jesus tells this guy to get up and then get the bed out of there, because he ain't coming back. There's no looking back. Take it, get up, and then get rid of whatever it is. And I want to encourage you, if there's something that if you've been keeping the bed around, now that you've been raised up, but you still got that garbage that you're keeping around just in case you need one on a rainy day or things get hard, just get out of your house. I don't know what it is you do, just get out of your house. All right, he's told to rise, he's told to take up his bed, he's told to walk, move forward. Don't stand there, move, progress, walk. You know, the Christian life, it's called our walk. We have a walk. And the thing about a walk is you make progress. Sometimes it's slow progress. Sometimes you make good progress, depending upon the terrain. But the idea is you're supposed to progress. You're supposed to, you know, we're told to grow in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. We're supposed to get somewhere. In fact, it's interesting to note when we get down to verse 14, this guy does walk, and then Jesus goes and finds him because he's got one more thing to say to him, and he finds him in the temple. After he's been made whole, he goes to the right place. And I would encourage you, walk to the right place. Where are you spending your time? What are you doing? Walk to the right place. So this guy gets up, rise, take up your bed and walk. Immediately the man was made whole. And to be honest with you, I think that is more than just physical healing. He was made whole. He took up his bed and he walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. This is funny. The Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, it's the Sabbath day. It's not lawful for you to carry your bed. And he answered them, he that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk. And they asked him, what man is it that said, which said unto thee, take up thy bed and walk? Now, picture this poor guy, okay? It's the Sabbath. And the Jews, the law said, you know, don't work on the Sabbath. They wanted to keep the law because they thought the law was something that would allow them to be righteous. And so they said, well, what does it mean to not work? That's all he says, don't work on the Sabbath. Well, what's work? How much is work? Where is the line? I need to know where the line is, because we all want to know where the line is so we can get just as close to it as we can, you know? Well, and they had it codified into, I think it was 613 do's and don'ts that made up the law. You know, the Sabbath day, work. Well, how far can I go on the Sabbath? Well, you're only allowed to go so far from your house. Any more than that, and you'd be on a journey, and that would be considered work. That's kind of limiting, though. But you know what you can do? If you take a rope, and you tie it to your front porch, and you stretch it out, say, 1,000 yards from your house, well, if you do that before the Sabbath, that becomes part of your house. So you can go to the end of the rope, and you're still technically in your house, so then you can go the extra distance. You know, they had it broken down to, you can't do any work on the Sabbath. And they had it down to stupid things like, well, the weight limit, I think, was a fig, like a dried fig or something. Anything that weighed more than a fig, if you picked that up, you were doing work. But if it was less than that, you were okay. And they had all these crazy laws. If you spit on the Sabbath, you could spit on a rock, that would be okay. But if you spit on the ground, that would be against the law. Because what would happen is, you know, you've spit in the sand before, and it kind of rolls. And it would dig a trench, and that would be plowing. So you can't spit in the ground. You can only spit in a rock. And you can't, ladies, you couldn't look in a mirror because you know what happens when you look in the mirror. You see the gray hair, and you know what you got to do when you see it until it's, you know, the harvest is full, and then there's no sense. But, I mean, when it's just one or two, you want to pull it out. Well, that would be harvesting. In fact, you couldn't pick your nose on the Sabbath because that would be harvesting. I mean, they had all of these laws. I'm telling you, it's true. And they had all of these stupid laws. And one of them was you don't carry anything way heavier than a fig. So this guy, Jesus, he's been laying there 38 years. Jesus says, get up and walk and take your bed. And he takes his bed and he starts walking. And they're like, hey, you can't do that today. This is a Sabbath, buddy. It's a wrong day for that. And this guy's thinking, it's the wrong day? I've been laying there for 38 years and you tell me it's the wrong day? But that's religion for you right there. It's not just here. In fact, in Luke chapter 13, another example, Jesus heals somebody, and it says, the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation because that Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day and said to the people, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them, therefore, come and be healed, and not on the Sabbath. There's 6 other days to be healed. Why does it have to be on... He can't heal anybody, no matter what day it is. Jesus is the only one that heals. Stupid. And they said, who said that you should carry your bed? And look at this. He that was healed wist not who it was. For Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in that place. He didn't even say who he was. He just showed up. He says, you want to be made whole? And the guy's like, I can't do anything. There's no man. And he says, well, take up your bed and walk. And then he leaves. He doesn't heal everybody at the pool. He heals one person. Sovereignly picks the one guy, and it's a guy who's immoral, and then he leaves, and he doesn't make a big show of it. He's not trying to draw attention to himself. He just pulls this guy out of the crowd, and the guy's like, I don't know who he was, you know. But look at this, verse 14. Afterward, Jesus findeth him in the temple and said unto him, behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. And you have to understand that is part of the message, and it has to be part of our message, because there are a lot of people who want to be healed. They want to be made whole, or they want to feel right about things, but yet they want to continue in their sin. This guy had obviously done something to bring this upon himself, and Jesus says, look, you've been made whole. Don't don't go back because something worse could happen. And that's always part of his message. You remember there's the woman, it's in, I forget where it is, who was caught in the very act of adultery, it says, and they dragged this poor woman caught in the act by herself. I don't know, apparently the other one was in the act, stayed home. But she's drugged there in front of Jesus in a crowd of all of these men. They bring this poor woman, probably still in the sheet, right, caught in the act, and says, the law says we should stone her. What do you say? And it says Jesus is just scribbling in the dirt. And there's been all kinds of speculations about what he's writing in the dirt. Some people say he's saying, where is the man? Some people say he's writing out their sins, you know, one after another. Because it says they all got rocks. And then starting from the oldest to the youngest, they begin to, from, you know, he says, let you, whoever is among you with no sin, cast the first stone. And then, you know, some people say, well, he's writing out their sins. We don't know what, whatever it is. It was inspired doodling, and they start dropping their stones until he's left there with a woman. And then he looks at her, and he says, woman, where are your accusers? And she says, there are none, Lord. And he says, neither do I accuse you. Now go back to what you were doing, because that poor guy is dying. I know you were caught in the act, and so just go. Now, he doesn't say that. He says, go and sin no more, all right? He doesn't say go back to your sin. He says, I'm not going to condemn you, but don't, you know, stop your sin. And that's part of the message here. And he goes back to this guy, finds him again, and says, sin no more. And the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. And look, how many people are going around healing people at this point? I think they had a pretty good idea who it was. But notice this, these last two verses, we'll end with this. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. But Jesus answered them, my Father worketh hitherto, and I work. You see, because their big deal is you can't work on the Sabbath. You know, God said he created everything in 6 days, and then on the seventh day he rested. And so we're supposed to work 6 days, and on the seventh day we're supposed to rest. It's true, but you have to understand, at the end of his 6 days of work, God looked at everything and he said, it's all good. But then man sinned. And so he started working again, because there's a whole bunch of sick and halt and lame and blind people who need to be saved. And he continues to work. And what Jesus says here, you don't understand, my dad's working again. And I'm going to continue working because it's not done. Now, eventually it will be done. He's going to say it is finished, and then he's going to sit down one more time and rest again. And then we're to enter into his rest. But Jesus said, my Father works and I work. And the deep thing about this for me is verse 16 says, therefore the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. And then if you continue to read, it says, and because he equates himself with God when he says, you know, my Father works and I work. Jesus specifically sought out this man among all the ones there that was lame, he was powerless, he was a sinner. He heals him. Then he goes and finds him again specifically to reveal himself to him, because he could have just, if his whole goal was for this guy to be made whole physically, he could have just skipped. Just like the boy that could have been healed from a distance, this guy could have been healed. But he doesn't. He goes back, and he specifically lets that guy know it was Jesus that healed you. And what verse 16 tells us is, this was the reason why they wanted to kill him. This guy is the reason why, ultimately, he was put to death. Because of this guy. And it was more important for this guy to realize who his Savior was than it was for Jesus to remain safe. You know, I look at what happened with the nobleman's son, and I see the compassion that Jesus had for his son. And I'm sure he saw something in him that showed him that he loved that son just as much as the father did. And then you see the compassion on this man who was there because of sin, who was completely helpless and had nobody, and Jesus goes out of his way, even though it's going to cost him his life, he wants to make sure that man knows, because it's more important that he be made spiritually whole than it is that he be made physically whole. Let me end there. Let me ask you this. Do you want to be made whole? And it's more than just a physical being made whole. Certainly, if there's any of you who are sick and you want someone to pray for you, come up, the elders and I will be glad to lay hands on you, pray for you, ask the Lord to heal you. But as always, he is much more interested in the spiritual being than he is the physical. Because you're eventually going to get sick and die. We all do. Last time I checked, 10 out of 10 people still die. But as we're going through Revelation, it says there are those who are born once and they end up dying twice, and then there are those who are born twice. They're born again, like he said to Nicodemus in John 3. They only die once because they've been made spiritually whole. If you have not responded to the gospel of Christ, if you have not asked him to be your Savior, you need to. And it's as simple as coming up, I'll lead you in a prayer, and it's just a matter of acknowledging that you are what he says you are, you want what he says that he'll give you. And if you have never done that, I encourage you, come up. You can start a life of being whole today. You got a song, Bobby? Let's pray. Lord, thank you that you found us. You sought us while we were strangers, wandering from the fold of God. Lord, and when there was no one, when we had no way, when we were powerless, we were blind, you made a way where there was no way. Lord, my prayer is that there's anybody here who does not know you.